Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. The tiny Persian Gulf nation of Bahrain and the popular uprising there is one topic today.
Secretary of State Clinton and Vice President Biden were saying things like, you know, Mubarak is our friend, Mubarak's not a dictator. The bad policy changed under public pressure. And I think the same thing would happen in the case of Bahrain if we could raise the level of attention on these issues.
The second topic is Iran, the senators who want to bomb it, and the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Senator Lieberman and Senator Graham have introduced a bill in the Senate which explicitly tries to pressure the administration to change the so-called red line that would provoke U.S. military action.
A third topic today on Talk Nation Radio, a military budget that grows even when they say it shrinks.
There have been no real cuts from previous levels. The military budget almost doubled since 2000. There is a lot of room to cut there.
Joining me today is Robert Naiman. Robert is policy director at Just Foreign Policy, where you can and should sign up for his daily email. He's a brilliant writer and activist who manages to know our government without, thank goodness, becoming anything like our government. Robert, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Good to be with you.
I want to hit a couple of topics today, if we have time, including Bahrain and Iran. And with regard to Bahrain, I understand you're just back from there, but you didn't get in. What happened with that?
So this past Tuesday was the one-year anniversary of the uprising in Bahrain. And it was widely expected that there would be a new wave of democracy protests in Bahrain for the anniversary, and so it was also expected that there would be a new wave of crackdown. So people in the democracy movement there were very eager to get international observers in, both to report out what was going on and as a deterrent to repression. This is in a context where the government of Bahrain has been tightening its grip not only on the people, but also on international. So they've been keeping out foreign journalists, they've been keeping out Human Rights First, Human Rights Watch, Citizens for Human Rights, have been blocked from going into Bahrain. So an invitation was issued, an open invitation was issued by groups in Bahrain saying, well, anybody come. Come as a tourist, come however you can, and come to accompany us and watch and report. So a project was set up called Witness Bahrain, witnessbahrain.org, and people from around the world, but particularly from the West, responded to this call. I mean, that was particularly directed at the West with the idea that, you know, Westerners have the greatest reporting effect because the story we want to get out in the United States and other Western countries that back the Bahraini government. So a number of us attempted to make the journey. Three of us were blocked in various ways. Kathy Kelly applied for a visa in advance and was denied. Two of us were blocked in the airport. I arrived in the small hours of Monday morning and didn't make it through the security interview and was told the director of immigration has decided that you will not have a visa to enter Bahrain. So I spent the next 36 hours in the airport doing my best to write and tweet and share information as I could. Fortunately, the airport had good Wi-Fi connection. But other people got in, Medea Benjamin, Tag Berry, Hawida Araf, and folks can see their reporting on the Witness Bahrain website. Two people were deported even before I arrived. Six others were deported after I arrived.
Robert, can we back up a minute just yes. for people who are U.S. consumers of television and newspaper and may not know that much about Bahrain to begin with? I mean, we hear a lot of evil things about Syria and Iran and certain nations, and a lot of people may not know where Bahrain is, how big it is, who lives there, what kind of government it has.
Yeah, Bahrain is a chain of islands in the Persian Gulf. Off the east coast of Saudi Arabia, just northwest of Qatar. You can't, it's so small you can't even see it on a map of the Middle East. You have to have a local map, you know, smaller area map to see it. You're right that there, although there's some press attention in the U.S., it's not like Syria at all. It's an instance of what Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman referred to as, you know, worthy and unworthy victim, the Syrians struggling against their government are worthy victims, that they're useful for U.S. foreign policy, but the people struggling for democracy in Bahrain are an annoyance because the government of Bahrain is allied to the United States. There's some unique things about Bahrain among the countries that have experienced vigorous protest movements in the Arab Spring. It has a U.S. naval base, the headquarters of the Sixth Fleet, U.S. Navy's Sixth Fleet, are there. It's in the Gulf, and it's very close to Saudi Arabia, where there's even less tolerance of dissent. You know, Mubarak's Egypt looks like freewheeling libertinism compared to the restrictions on dissent in Saudi Arabia, for example. And they have a minority regime, in the sense that something like 70% of the native population is Shia, and the government, which is a monarchy, a real monarchy, not a constitutional monarchy like Britain. The government is controlled by the king, and they've had a monarchy for hundreds of years. This situation is somewhat similar to the situation that existed in Iraq under Saddam Hussein before the U.S. invasion. You know, with great fanfare, the U.S. overthrew Saddam and said we're bringing democracy. Well, there's a similar terrain in Bahrain today, that you have autocratic regime based in a minority of the population. And the protest in Bahrain didn't start with the Arab Spring, although it started a revival. They had a kind of series of uprisings, intifada, in the 1990s, where the political forces representing the majority of the population agitating for their rights. The Shia population has complained for decades that they suffer discrimination, they're excluded from government. In the wake of the uprising last year, there was a purge of the professional classes, a crackdown on doctors and lawyers, and particularly healthcare providers who treated protesters that were injured by security forces, been cracked down by the government. And this has been reported in the U.S. press, not prominently. As I said, it's not useful. It's an awkwardness for the U.S. government that claims to support popular aspirations in the region. It's definitely not supporting popular aspirations in the case of Bahrain.
And this is a situation where this past week, as you said, some U.S. and other foreign observers got in and in some cases were arrested, were deported, were tear gassed with U.S.-made tear gas, were shipped out of the country, and you hear very little about it from the U.S. government or the U.S. Major corporate media. And I was at a conference in Washington, D.C. this past week with doctors and lawyers who work on issues of torture. And there were lawyers and activists and doctors from Bahrain there who've started up an organization called BRAVO, Bahrain Rehabilitation and Anti-Violence Organization, where they try to rehabilitate torture survivors. And these are protesters who are arrested for protesting, and they're lawyers who are arrested for defending them. It's a society that seems to have very little conception of civil liberties or the rule of law. And they were sort of asking me, what would have an impact as we go to Congress here in your nation and try to talk to them? What would they care about? And the only thing I could think of was perhaps what it costs for all of those ships and all of those sailors that are docked there in their port. Otherwise, it's very hard for me to imagine. What do you think would have an impact? What could people in this country or our government possibly do?
First of all, I think it's worth noting that we're not starting from zero. Last year, the Obama administration proposed a major arms package for Bahrain, and people in Congress of both parties protested, and the administration delayed the arms sale indefinitely, at least that package, indefinitely. So it's not the case that nobody in Congress is aware of this or cares about it. There are members of Congress of both parties that have been pressing on this. More recently, just in the last couple of weeks, the Obama administration announced that it was putting forward a smaller package of arms sales. Under the congressional rules, the notification requirements are different if the package is under $1 million. So the administration said, you know, we don't need congressional approval for this. Nonetheless, several members of Congress protested. Senator Ron Wyden, Representative Jim McGovern, sent a letter to the administration saying that this is sending the wrong signal There should be no arms sales, U.S. arms sales to Bahrain while the repression continues. So we're not starting from zero. I think that the key thing is raising the profile of these issues. These issues are being reported in the U.S. press, but just not being reported prominently. So, for example, if you go to the New York Times website, it's actually a bunch of reporting on the website. The print edition, they just had, you know, one little paragraph brief when the six Americans were deported. But on the Leave blog, there was quite a bit of reporting about what was going on with videos, protests, and so on. And this is something that, you know, anybody with the internet connection can follow and get access to and spread. We saw in the case of Egypt that U.S. policy shifted dramatically over a short period of time from the beginning of the uprising there, where Secretary of State Clinton and Vice President Biden were saying things like, no, Mubarak is our friend, Mubarak's not a dictator. That policy changed under public pressure. Americans were watching protests on TV. American TV anchors were in Tahrir Square. People could see, you know, ordinary Egyptians standing up against the government and facing repression. And that was a context in which it was very hard for U.S. officials to defend the assertion that, you know, this government is our friend. You know, I think the same thing would happen in the case of Bahrain if we could raise the level of attention on these issues. So I think it's, you know, like what we're doing now, talking about these issues on the radio, sharing information over the internet about particular cases, sharing videos from protests in Bahrain. I think all these things will contribute to raising the public profile, as well as people directly lobbying Congress in opposition to arms sales, in support of putting pressure on the administration to pressure the government of Bahrain to allow foreign observers, journalists, and human rights groups to enter the country.
Well, I appreciate everything you're doing to try to make that happen. You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson speaking with Robert Nayman of Just Foreign Policy. I want to shift topics to the looming possibility of an attack by this country, or an attack tolerated by this country, by Israel, on the nation of Iran, and what role in that the lobby group AIPAC may be playing. AIPAC has a conference coming up with a corresponding protest called Occupy AIPAC. Can you tell us what AIPAC is and what it is doing and what its aims are with regard to Iran?
AIPAC stands for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It bills itself as America's pro-Israel lobby. The Washington Post referred to it as the National Rifle Association of Foreign Policy, only more powerful, perhaps, even than the NRA because of its deep reach into both of the major political parties. If you go to AIPAC's website now or any time in the last several years and you look at their legislative priorities, the top issue is Iran. And AIPAC has led the charge for U.S. to impose crippling sanctions against Iran, which brought us to the current juncture. Many people probably don't realize that, you know, the latest round of threats that burst into the media with the new, you know, new fear of war started when Congress passed a bill to force the administration to impose sanctions on Iran, a central bank, and try to cut off Iran's oil export. Of course, an embargo on a country is an act of war, and it was in response to that threat by the U.S. and countries in Western Europe to try to cut off Iran's oil export that some Iranian officials threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz, which is a major choke point for international oil traffic. So the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, has a lot to do with leading us to the current juncture. So far, although AIPAC and others, you know, have this formulation of nothing off the table, which everybody understands means military threat, the main emphasis of AIPAC has not been openly calling for war. It's been pushing these, you know, crippling, aggressive sanctions, which of course have something to do with war, both because an embargo is an act of war and because, you know, pushing the government of Iran to the wall provokes a response. But we may be on the cusp of a change in that fact, as Senator Lieberman and Senator Graham have introduced a bill in the Senate, which explicitly tries to pressure the administration to change the so-called red line that would provoke U.S. military action. President Obama has said, Secretary Panetta has said, that the U.S. red line is that Iran can't develop a nuclear weapon. AIPAC and Senator Lieberman and Senator Graham want to change that to say that the red line is that Iran can't develop a nuclear weapons capability. This is extremely dangerous, in part because many experts believe that, in fact, Iran already has the technological scientific capacity to build a nuclear weapon if they chose to do so. U.S. officials have said repeatedly, and U.S. intelligence agencies have said, that they don't believe that Iran is currently trying to develop a nuclear weapon. They simply believe that Iran is developing the technological and scientific capacity to do so in the future, should they choose to do so. So what this Lieberman-Graham bill would do is create a red line that arguably already exists today. People could say that war is justified today. The AIPAC policy conference is March 4th to 6th in Washington, so that's coming right up. It's a major Washington event. Leaders from both parties go, and then thousands of AIPAC activists swarm Capitol Hill, carrying with them whatever AIPAC legislative priorities are. Ron Campeas in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency reported that it's expected that this Lieberman-Graham bill would be an ask of the AIPAC policy conference. So we may see, coming out of this conference on March 4th and 6th, AIPAC much more explicitly, and there are thousands of activists much more explicitly, calling for a policy of war now.
Now, in what sense is that, or is that not, a pro-Israel position? Do the people of Israel want Iran attacked either by their own country or ours?
Well, the phrase pro-Israel is very unfortunate. What these people are really about is not the well-being of some pensioner in Haifa or Tel Aviv, but the Israeli government, and particularly the right wing of the Israeli government, which has a very confrontational policy towards Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu, this is his personal crusade. Others, even in Israeli government circles, you know, former head of Mossad, said that the idea of an Israeli attack on Iran was the craziest thing he'd ever heard. Other Israeli officials have made similar statements. And, you know, nobody knows if Israel were to attack Iran or if the United States were to attack Iran. As David Petraeus put it, you know, how does this end? Of course Iran will retaliate. And we don't know, you know, then does Iran retaliate by attacking the U.S.? You know, drawing in the U.S.
Meaning so, U.S. troops in its relative vicinity, not the actual so-called homeland, right?
Who knows? There is a lot of speculation in the press now about possibilities that, you know, Iranian agents or somebody acting on the behest of Iran might carry out some attack in the United States. This is obviously very controversial and disputed. But the possibility can't be ruled out completely. I mean, one should be skeptical of the hype, but the probability is not zero. After all, what the Iranian government has been doing for the last several years, they appear to believe that the probability that the U.S. and or Israel would attack them at some point is very high. And, you know, they have good reason for believing that. And their strategy to try and deter that is to develop multiple counter threats. And if the U.S. or Israel attacks Iran and they don't do anything in response, you know, that's sort of like the maximum thing, a U.S. or Israeli attack. So then they have, you know, then maybe they have to do their maximum response. If they want to, you know, have the reputation of a country that can't be pushed around. So while I think, you know, we should be skeptical of the hype, at the same time, we don't really know what could happen if Israel attacks Iran or if U.S. attacks Iran. There are lots of theaters. Lebanon is a theater. Iraq is a theater. Afghanistan is a theater. And there Iran, like Hezbollah and Lebanon, to have their own grievances with the United States and Israel. And where there's longstanding tension. And it's also been speculated that Israel might launch a preemptive strike in Lebanon against Hezbollah as part of an attack on Iraq. So there is a real danger of more generalized conflict. And nobody can really say how far it would go, which is why this idea of a military attack is so dangerous.
I agree, and this very line of thinking is also, I would argue, among the stupidest reasons I've ever heard for starting a war. Because Iran is threatening to fight back if we attack it, we must attack it. I think is beyond crazy. And in the few minutes we have left, I wonder if we could turn to the general approach that our government takes to the world. Robert, you were good enough to speak at a conference down here in Charlottesville back in September that's now turned into a book with a chapter from you called The Military Industrial Complex at 50. Now it's 51 years since Eisenhower used that phrase. But our discussion last fall was about the possibility of having military spending actually cut, at least in some minimal way, in Washington. And that still is mandated by law at this point. But the White House has put out proposals to undo it. The Pentagon is in favor of undoing it. There are bills in both houses of Congress to undo it. Will military spending be cut?
Well, we're already in a better position than we were when I gave that talk. I gave that talk in the chapter in the book, it was during the period of the super committee deliberation. And under the Budget Control Act, if the super committee failed to reach agreement, then this automatic sequesters, automatic military cuts would be triggered. The super committee failed to reach agreement, which from the standpoint of wanting to cut the military budget was almost surely the best outcome. Any agreement by the super committee would have cut the military budget less than the automatic sequester. Of course, one has to be careful with the word cut. You know, what we've seen so far, what President Obama has proposed so far, is essentially cutting the previously projected increase. So his most recent budget proposal for 10 years essentially holds military spending about constant in real terms. That's not a cut from previous, but it's a big shift in what was previously planned because the military spending was on a dramatic growth path. But that doesn't count. The president's proposal doesn't count the sequester, the automatic budget cuts, which are still pending, will still happen in January 2013 if there's not agreement to do something else. And that would result in a real cut in military spending, even in terms of inflation-adjusted dollars. So we're on a path that does allow for military cuts. And if you follow the press, the kind of inside military press, they are talking about not doing things. They are talking about cutting real things from the budget. They're talking about bringing home troops from Europe. They're talking about abandoning the strategy for a major counterinsurgency war. So military cuts are in the offing. Of course, there's tremendous blowback from the military-industrial complex, from the pro-military spending Republicans who are saying, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. By no means can we be complacent about this. People need to press members of Congress to cut the military budget. And of course, part of that is pressing against other cuts. The real trade-offs now between cuts in military spending and cuts in the domestic budget, including Social Security and Medicare benefits. So we're on the path, but by no means is success assured.
Well, I'm very glad you take the glass half full view. To play devil's advocate, are we not, by some measures, worse off in that much of the public has been persuaded that cuts, serious military cuts, have already happened and are happening? Again, largely a deception, cuts on projected budgets and so forth, but I don't think that's how the public sees it. There is a propaganda campaign around the danger to jobs, the danger to the economy, if additional cuts, as they call it, should be allowed to happen. And again, the president, the White House, the Pentagon, members of both parties in both houses of Congress are pushing the idea of undoing the military cuts, undoing cuts to so-called defense and changing them into cuts to so-called security, or better, cuts to the entire budget as a whole. There's a column in the Charlottesville newspaper this past weekend from a Bloomberg columnist pushing the idea that if we bring any troops home from abroad, we will be hurting the economies of the nations where they are stationed, as if our military occupations are a philanthropic effort for those abroad. It's foreign aid. This is what people seem to hear from newspapers and television. How do we turn that around, if you can answer that in about 2 minutes?
Well, there is a tremendous amount of propaganda along this line. It's not clear to me that they're moving public opinion that much. If you look at polls where they ask people, you know, what do you think we should do about the budget, still overwhelmingly people prefer military cuts and raising taxes on the rich to cutting domestic spending. But, you know, we can fight back. People can write letters to the editor. People can call in. People can do public propaganda to show the real numbers. We should all be doing more of that. But I think it's important not to, you know, part of the way this propaganda works is just kind of beating people down with the repetition. So it's just important to reemphasize people that, you know, first of all, so far, there have been no real cuts from previous levels. The cut from the previously projected growth path, the military budget almost doubled since 2000. There is a lot of room to cut there. The military spending is the majority of federal discretionary spending, so there's a lot of room there. Particularly if you want the U.S. military to do less in the world, which, you know, many of us do. If you're not going to invade and occupy other countries, then you don't need as big U.S. military. You're not going to have bases all over the world. You don't need as big a U.S. military. So there's lots of room to cut. And so it's just important for people not to be tricked by this propaganda and continue to put a good information out there. But so far, I don't think they have, you know, the majority of Democrats in Congress are not saying repeal the military sequester. It's just a faction of Republicans so far that want to just repeal the military sequester.
On those words of encouragement, Robert Nayman, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. My guest next week will be Hunter Link, one of some 20 University of Virginia students who have stopped eating until the university pays its workers a living wage. Until then.